also was a place that sold coax in large quantities on large rolls. And sometimes he had like 50 or 100 feet or 75 feet left over on one of these large reels, and he would sell it to hams very, very cheap over.
Well, I mean, the whole story with coaxial cables is one of Army surplus. Before World War II, it was too expensive a technology. I think almost all hams used open wire. But when World War II finally ended and the FCC allowed amateurs to get back on the air, there were miles upon miles upon miles of Army surplus coaxial cables that all the hams picked up for a dime. And then I guess it became more of a case of if you manufacture enough of something, the price, the cost for it, it decreases. So that's how, in a way, coaxial cables became ubiquitous for us amateur radio operators. And of course, everyone who's listened to the TechNet for more than a few years remember Dick telling us how he had a great deal. He would follow around cable companies, and they would have these enormous coils of quad shielded 75 ohm cable television cables. And, you know, when they got down to their last 100 or 200 feet, it didn't pay for them to keep the spindle, so he could get it for a song. So he had a lot of quarter-shielded 75-ohm transmission lines that he used. Now, once again, this continues to be AC2GS with the Kings County, with the Lymar Technical Net. And it's a quiet, quiet night in this area. So if you're out there and you have some topic for discussion, some comments to be made, please hit that push to talk.
WP2AHK.
Yes, Jeff.
Well, you brought up something in my mind about war surplus. Can I talk about aviation and war surplus?
Sure, Jeff.
All right, well, I'm 78 years old, still percolating at this time. But back in 1955, I was 10 years old, and my father and another war veteran, a friend of his, bought a Army surplus Curtiss PT-19 aircraft. I can't tell you how much they paid for it because I was only 10 years old, and I didn't ask those details, but they were flying it around the New York Harbor, and one day my father's partner asked me if I'd like to go for a ride in the Army surplus PT-19. Let me let it drop. So there was a little airport between Floyd Bennett Field and Idlewild called Far Rockaway Airport. It's projects now for many, many years, but it was a dirt flying field with potholes. And the partner took me up in the PT-19 war surplus aircraft. And we were flying over Jamaica Bay. And by the way, let me describe the plane. It might be interesting to people. It was a low wing. It was a single wing plane, a war surplus training plane for pilots that came out in the 1930s. And it had a wind-up, had no electrical system. It had a wind-up engine, big engine. It had a handle like a Model T, and you would wind it up with a handle and took a couple of minutes of turning the handle like a watch spring, and then somebody would be sitting in the plane, and they released the clutch or whatever it was, and the engine would take out the handle, and then the engine would start the crank and start up. Mickey was his name. He looked like one of these characters on these old movies that you would think about somebody flying a plane, a World War II type plane. He was an interesting character. But at any rate, we were flying over Jamaica Bay, and he said, "Let me show you how it goes, this was a training plane and an aerobatic plane." So over Reese Park, I was sitting in one of the cupolas. They had two little cupolas with two little windshields on this plane, one in the front, one in the back, obviously. And so I was trapped in the back one, and we were over Reese Park, and he did aerobatics over Reese Park. I was upside down for a while looking down at the people at Reese Park. And we were flying over for 5 or 10 minutes doing all kinds of things, loops and all kinds of things. And anyhow, so it was open cockpit. There was no roof over your head. You were just strapped in. So communication was a little bit difficult, but the next thing you know, he flew over Jamaica Bay, and there's sandbars in Jamaica Bay, and he landed on one of the sandbars in the middle of Jamaica Bay. And if you ever did that today, the Coast Guard and the police would be there in a second, and there would be all kinds of emergency services showing up if a plane landed in the middle of Jamaica Bay on a sandbar. But we landed on a sandbar in the middle of Jamaica Bay. So anyhow, we got out, and we shut off the engine, and then we looked around a little bit. I don't remember how we turned it around or whatever. Maybe we moved the tail around to point it in a certain direction so we could take off again. But we were in the middle of Jamaica Bay on a sandbar. And I only remember that Smokey, the pilot, was winding up the engine. I was inside, and he had told me that contact at ignition beforehand what to do. And he pulled out the handle. He said, "Contact ignition," and he let the thing go, and the engine started cranking, and he hopped on the plane, and we took off in an Army surplus PT-19 from the middle of Jamaica Bay and flew back to the Far Rockaway Airport. I just wanted to tell you how things were back in 1955, and it was freedom in the air, and I don't know how many years they had that plane, but it was quite an experience for a 10-year-old kid. Go ahead.
AC2GS. Well, that was an interesting story. You lived a dangerous life. Exciting. I don't know how many kids are doing loop-de-loops. I had a much more kind of safer, although intellectually weird, experience. My father, may he rest in peace, used to regularly take a stroll down to Sheepshead Bay, and he took me along, and the guy who owned the candy store, he also had a colorful name. He was Red. And he would kibitz with him about the Lower East Side and such things, and then finally, I was kind of bored because I didn't understand what the hell they were talking about. I was about 8, 9 years old. And, you know, we said goodbye, we started walking home, and he says, "You see that guy? That guy used to work for Murder Incorporated. He used to kill people for a living." So thankfully, Red didn't demonstrate any of his prowess in my presence.
Comment?
Yes? Yes, someone wants to comment.
Well, I really enjoyed those stories of the PC-2 and C-2. You know, the Library of Congress, they love these kind of stories and archive them. I forget what the name of that project is at the moment. It'll lose me, but there is a project to take these kind of stories and put them into the National Archives. So maybe something to consider. I mean, that's an awesome story that probably very few people have ever heard.
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, there's so many great stories that people have heard each other tell each other. Very little gets recorded and held on to. You know, there are special cases where that happens. It's sort of a shame that there isn't the kind of open environments that the kind of tell the story, submit it in audio file form, and have it collected. You'd think archive.org would sort of do something like that. it's nice to hear you, John. I don't know if you heard me earlier. I was wondering if the guys over at Los Alamos enjoyed the Oppenheimer movie.
I have heard a few good, well, everything I've heard has been good, and the few I've really got some detail on, they were pretty impressed with the movie, despite the 3-hour time sync. But yeah, everyone that I've talked to seems pretty happy, and I'm excited to go see it. Probably the first time in a while that I've been excited to see a movie. I think the last thing that I really wanted to see was Blade Runner 2046, and that was, I don't know, 5, 6 years ago. So reports are good.
Yeah, it is a little daunting in that it's 3 hours. I'm reading the book. I figure that I could read the book, finish it, and then by then hopefully it will be available on streaming. So, a little bit easier to schedule something like that. But I'm looking forward to it as well. I'm interested in the subject material, and Nolan is a great director. I love a lot of the movies that he has directed. And, you mentioned Blade Runner. I don't know. I didn't quite like it as much as the original Blade Runner, but that could be nostalgia on my part.
Yeah, and a comment might be that maybe it'll help people understand the full story. Hopefully a lot of people see it and really take it in. And, I'm not pro-nuke. I'm not, I don't want to see nuclear war. I don't want to see stockpiles increase to the point where, we guarantee our own self-destruction, but that horse is bolted, as the Australians say. Maybe it'll help people understand where we are now. We got to be less of the less strange views on how we got here and what it all means. Unfortunately, we're here, and nothing we can do about it. But Blade Runner, yeah. So I remember I was taking my wife's car to get new tires and an alignment, and I watched the original Blade Runner the night before. Got up in the morning, drove her car to Santa Fe, and dropped it off at the tire place, and walked a mile or two away to the theater and watched 2049. So I watched them both in succession. I hadn't seen the original for quite a few years, maybe decades. And I enjoyed both, really. The original is pretty good and probably hard to beat.
Yeah, I remember looking up the reviews at the time, and a lot of the big reviewers panned Blade Runner. It was too depressing. They really didn't like what the director thought of what the future might be. It was very kind of techno-punk type of thing. I loved it. I didn't like the theatrical release as much as I liked further future iterations. Apparently, the movie studio thought the whole thing was way too confusing, so they forced Harrison Ford to do a voiceover explaining the scenes as they were going on, and you could sort of tell that Harrison Ford was not in a good mood, and he was just kind of sleepwalking through it. But they must have re-edited that poor movie at least 4 or 5 times, and I saw every last one of them. And I particularly the ones without the voiceovers. Especially by then, I knew what was going on. I didn't need Harrison Ford telling me what was going on.
Yeah, so I didn't realize that was a thing, that people didn't know what was going on. I remember seeing it, again, 6 years ago. I didn't have any trouble understanding what was going on. I assume whatever I watched 6 years ago was edited in some fashion, based on what you said, but it didn't hit me, so I guess I didn't recognize that there was a change, but a lot of time had passed. So that'll be interesting. I wonder if you can watch the original.
Yeah, if you look for the theatrical release, I don't think they killed the copies. It's a little difficult finding them, but it's not like they sequestered them, like they locked them up and threw them in a pit someplace. So, worst comes to worst, you could sail the high seas and find a copy of the theatrical. Like I said, you know, there are some movies that were reissued so many different times that it was almost ridiculous. I mean, Terminator was another one that was, they just kept on cranking out versions of that. But the big question with Blade Runner at the time was the arguments people had back and forth of whether Harrison Ford was a replicant himself, which I think they sort of answered in the 2025 movie.
Yeah, I think you're right. They don't hint to it, but they leave you thinking, right? I think that's the way I came away from it. They leave you thinking and wondering. It's always fun. You know, you leave a movie with all questions answered, it seems like you've been shorted. You know, it doesn't have to all be answered and all be solved.
Yeah, I agree with you. It's perfectly fine to leave some questions unanswered. And I think the principal example of where it could go terribly wrong was in Star Wars. I didn't care what the nature of the Force was. Star Wars was kind of more of a fantasy than a science fiction, so I didn't expect the laws of physics to be carried out. And so when they came up with midichlorians, it just depressed me. It didn't help me at all.
Yes, I don't know if you delve into the depths of the current offering on, like, Disney Plus or Star Wars. There are endless opportunities to watch all these spin-off things that they've done. And some are good. You know, I enjoyed Mandalorian, as long as you take it with a grain of salt, if it's like a spaghetti western. Or the other good one was The Bad Batch, it's an animated series. I watched that with my kids. And I'm watching kind of all of it now because my kids are into it. Some of it is just absolute dribble. It's hard to watch. But yeah, I'm not a huge fan of the Star Wars series. It's hard not to be a fan of some sort with as popular as it is. And as easy it is, as it is to find and hear and see at all levels of life. But some of it's worth watching. I will say that. Yes.
ACTGS. Yeah, it sort of depends. It's real haphazard. There were some nice approaches to the material, especially in novelization. There was a series that I think they're really looking to make into a series of movies. It's called the Thrawn Trilogy, where it's a very alien commander of a battleship that takes off after the Empire collapses and tries to reestablish it himself. That was a novelization that was very popular at the time. And I think they've already cast an actor to play that character. They haven't quite figured out whether they're going to make it a TV series or a movie. They got to get better writers. I don't know what the hell is happening in Hollywood. I don't know any writers, so I don't know what's going on. It seems like they're scraping the bottom of the barrel, because they all seem to come up with the same hackneyed plot devices. You know, you have this 5'2", 98-pound young woman who's smarter and stronger and bigger and faster than anything else, and she wins at the beginning, she wins at the middle, she wins at the end. There's no character development in a lot of screenplays these days, which is weird. I mean, there used to be a character development.
Yeah, you're getting a little noisy to the point where I can't understand you, but at the end there, I didn't know if you said you were letting go to let the machine reset or not, so I'm going to pause for a second, make sure I have it. Yeah, real good. I don't know. I'm not a huge fan of all the whiz-bang. I like a story to build a little more. I like a story to develop, the characters develop, pauses, things that make you think. It's probably one of the reasons I like Blade Runner. It isn't so fast-paced. There are, panoramics and pauses and things, and they'll just focus on one thing for a few seconds without jumping to the next thing as fast as possible. And a really good example of the worst case of this is the remake of, what's the one where Danger Will Robinson, is that Lost in Space? Is that it? No, it's not the right name. What's the one with Danger Will Robinson? They did a remake of that, and it was just horrible. I'm watching that. The whole point was for them was to get to the next fantastic thing that could happen with very little story in between. That was not a concern at all. Just how fast can we get to the next fantastic, crazy thing?
Yeah, that was Lost in Space. I don't know. I'm taking a look at my sound envelope. It looks reasonable. It's very difficult for me to figure out if there's a lot of background noise on it. But, yeah, that was Lost in Space. I didn't really like the original Lost in Space. It was really low budget. It was cheesy. They had the characters turning into vegetables on one episode. I almost never got around to watching Star Trek simply because Lost in Space kind of soured me on the whole idea of television science fiction. But finally, about the summer of the first season, I tuned into the repeats and I fell in love with it. But yeah, the movie was not terribly good either. A lot of remake movies tend to really be awful. I used to love Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. I read all the books. I listened to the radio drama. I watched the television series, and then they brought it into a movie, and the movie was garbage.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
Netflix ran a series, and you can still watch it on Lost in a whole bunch of episodes. And it was pretty well done, you know. I thought it was okay. Big improvement. Nothing like that movie they came out with, and nothing like the terrible original one with Dr. Smith and all that nonsense. But they did a very good updated version. It was a series. It was still is. Back to you, bro.
Yeah, I heard that they had done a TV series, but again, I was not a big fan, so I never actually took the time to check it out. I think the whole idea of Dr. Smith was sort of discovered accidentally. He was just kind of the evil person, you know, the enemy for the first pilot, and then they just thought so highly of the character that they kept him on. And, you know, I mean, I would love to kind of see people with 21st century attitudes watch that for the first time, where the character really comes across as someone you wouldn't want to leave with your young children. He doesn't strike me as someone who would be a good person to leave children with, you know, if you know what I mean.
Okay, yeah, understood. Anyway, in the Netflix version, Dr. Smith is a woman doctor. They changed things. Back to you, Ron.
Yeah, it's kind of a reflex. You know, it was an interesting thing back in, you know, 2001, 2002. One of the first ones that I remember was they were doing a redo of Battlestar Galactica, which was also a rather cheap and chintzy type of a production originally in the 80s. So they're going to redo it for the 21st century, and of course, you know, one of the main male characters, they did the sex swap, and they did the female, and they did it well, they cast it well, they wrote it well, it was great. But ever since then, it seems like the default is, yeah, we got to swap half of their sexes, you know? And, you know, if they're women, then you got to make them a minority woman. And then if they're a minority woman, I don't know what the hell you do with them these days. Make them a person who's small? I don't know. I don't know what the rule book is these days.
Probably make them an android or something.
Well, they were playing around with Androids as far back as, the 1950s. They were building Androids. One of my favorite really bad movies is Creation of the Humanoid, in which it was the 1950s, I think it was black and white, science fiction, where there were a whole group of servile androids that did the labors of the human beings, and then there was a threatened revolt. And it was poorly written, poorly acted, poorly produced, but it was loads of fun to watch when I was 10 years old, and it was on WR Million Dollar Movie.
Okay, I missed the name of the show you were talking about. You were clipping in and out.
Oh, okay. Sorry to hear that. Have it up to the highest power of my radio will transmit. It was Creation of the Humanoid. Very difficult to find.
Yeah, tough copy. Something humanoids. Okay. Hopefully the crack is clear up. I don't know if you're getting that on mine. My signal, but it's pretty much on your signal. You know, the beginning of the night, first half hour was just great. But then little problems. You know, you heard it on Wesley's signal as well. Back to you.
Call your DSQ AFCC.
Yes.
Okay, very good. Thank you.
Yeah, someone threw out their call sign?
I gave the call sign, AF2P, Alpha Foxtrot 2 Papa.
Oh, what can I do for you? What can I do for you, sir?
I know you asked him a question, Roy, but your signal is really breaking up.
What's going on with the repeater?
Hopefully it clears up shortly.
It seems to be doing all kinds of...
Roy, I just wanted to comment to Paul because he wondered if he was noisy or not, and I just told him he was DFQ. You are very noisy. That's all I had to say, AF2P.
Okay, very good. I don't know what to tell you about what to do about this signal, but that's, putting out 50 watts, that's all my ICOM 7100 is going to do tonight. So... we'll see if it's survivable. Anyway, I think Wesley wanted to talk about superconducting devices at room temperature. So are you around, Wesley?
And that transmission was good, Roy.
Oh, good. I didn't do anything different. It's the same radio, antenna, power supply, what have you. So I don't know exactly what's happening at the repeater. It seems to be losing sensitivity for this portion of Brooklyn. I don't know.
Okay, well, you're doing okay. I mean, it's still crackly, but very, you're understandable at this point. Yeah, somebody's probably up on a roof shaking the antenna back and forth every now and then. It's very intermittent. You know, it's one of those deals.
Okay, it's a shame I don't have a wind indicator for the location of the repeater. It would kind of give me a little bit more insight into what's going on. So let me ask again, because I think Wesley said he was going to go back to working on the antenna. He may or may not be here by 9:30. So are you out there, Wesley?
Yes, I am. Let me check. So far, so good. But it looks like my tuner is not holding the power. I mean, it's supposed to hold 100 watts, 300 watts. I'm pulling right now 30 watts, and I'm having a problem. Hold on. Okay, anyhow. Team of South Korea researchers reported room temperature superconductor. I had all material prepared, but I lost it somewhere. But anyhow, so it's room temperature, so it's like 22 degrees centigrade, 21 degrees centigrade. It's Cu2PB2, phosphate generating internal stress. So it's like when you have that rapid change the transition, then is when you have that effect of zero resistance. I'm not sure. Did you read that article?
Yes, I read the article.
Okay, so can you do the talking? Because I'm afraid about my antenna.
Okay, I mean, I read it. I didn't memorize it. Basically, there's a very strange Korean group. They have been working on a room temperature superconductor, which is, you know, it's kind of like the golden fleece. It's kind of, you know, you're guaranteed to get a Nobel Prize off of it. So they've been working on it for at least 10 years. And there's been a lot of problems in the literature on this subject. There's been other labs that have submitted papers of similar types of things and then had to pull them because they didn't pan out, because most people take a rather simple approach to the superconductors, that you just kind of put it in a voltometer, it reads zero, and there you go. It's a lot more difficult to test small samples of superconductors, so a lot of times these things don't pan out. So there seems to be a kind of group and supergroup. There are three guys who file the paper. I think because the Nobel Prize only gives you three winners. You can't issue a paper with five people and get a Nobel Prize for the five people. So there was one submission from three people, and then there was another submission from a larger group, like six or seven of the coworkers in the lab. So you have competing papers. None of them have been verified yet. If it comes to pass, it can change the very nature of our modern technology. Of course, you know, the idea is always that you want, you would like a superconductor that works at room temperature, so you don't have to cool it with expensive liquid helium. And also, some near room temperature superconductors require ridiculous pressures to operate, you know, 1,000 times the pressure at ground, the atmospheric pressure. This requires no excessive pressure, no excessive temperature, but they haven't really given details of other important things. This material is not really a alloy, so it's not going to work like a piece of wire. It's more ceramic. It kind of means it's brittle, which is difficult to form into really significant objects. Also, what they haven't indicated is at what point it kind of fizzles out, because all superconductors tend to dissipate if the local magnetic field gets too strong. So there is a limit.
Okay, what I'm reading here is copper, CO2, and lead, Pb2, which is phosphide, generating internal stress. So the distortion induced by the submission of the internal stress is generating superconductivity. So it's like when you have that phase change, then is when it is manifesting superconductivity. So I'm not sure if it's the phenomenon that is just changing phase, so then we have it and then we don't have it, or it's like changing phase and stays there. Dr. Ray.
I don't think it's a proper phase change. You know, and phases are, you know, solid, liquid, gas. It's a crystal matrix that's mostly a lead-based ceramic that has some lead atoms replaced with copper atoms that give it supposedly give it the unusual quality. Again, the most important thing to me is whether it pan out, and also what's the maximum amount of current. It is theoretically possible to get yourself finally discover a room temperature, normal pressure superconductor that can only conduct a microamp of current before it saturates to the magnetic field characteristic. So that's very important. You need something that's able to carry a lot of current. It's also a nice thing if it's not brittle and likely to break at any kind of moment. So this is the beginning of a very long trip. I'm not quite sure if this will pan out. Again, there have been other papers submitted and then retracted in the past, so this might be a kind of deja vu all over again. So, you know, the nuances of exactly how it works is probably not as important as finding out for sure that it does work.
Yeah, just found that the material is being called LK-99. So LK-99 is a mix of powder compounds of lead, oxygen, sulfur, and phosphorus. But you said it's ceramic. Some kind of loss there. When heated to very high temperature, it forms dark gray solid. Is that the ceramic that you're talking about?
Yes, it's a ceramic. It's not a metal alloy. It's a salt, so it's a ceramic.
So in other words, they take lead, oxygen, sulfur, phosphorus, they heat it to the high temperature, they cool it down, and then from that point, the transition is done, and now we have a superconductor. So in order to use it, we have to spray it in form of powder over the what? Because it's conducting, right? Over anything. So now we could have a computer at room temperature with no losses, right?
Well, I don't think the problem with computers is the connector losses. I think, unfortunately, the big problem is a lot of it gets used for junctions, and the junctions can't be substituted for by ceramics. You need a semiconductor material and dopants and such. So of all the things that it's going to help, I think the least likely is it's going to really do a great deal about computers. Computers now are researchers are really looking into different phenomena entirely, either different substrates for the semiconductor or even completely different architectures, where instead of operating with electrons, they're going to work with photonics and build devices that control photons instead of electrons. So there are other things that the superconductors would be incredibly useful. The amount of energy loss in transmission lines of power utilities, shrinking and making cheap MRIs. There's a lot of different things that a lossless material can cause produce great benefits for, but I don't think computers is really a major one.
Well, once we publish, that's gonna die, I hope. They have a patent application that they filed. There was some noise about those groups of major Korean scientists and then some helpers that were trying to get a piece of pie, and that's why that whatever promotion for being in the group of people who dreamed to have a Nobel Prize for it started. Am I right?
KC2GS. Well, it certainly is making the whole thing excessively confusing. There's way too many confusing things. I mean, I've often mentioned that science isn't quite as clean and sterile as it appears in science textbooks. You know, it kind of seems matter of fact. A bunch of guys go into labs, they come up with the answer, and they publish it, and they move on to the next thing. It's usually a lot messier, but this is excessively messy. I mean, one of the sites of the laboratory I think it's also a business venture. So these guys are really looking, and, you know, if it pans out, it's, you know, it's worth probably trillions, so I can understand. But they put up very strange bits and pieces of things. There's an image on one of the websites from the discoverers showing a small coin-shaped, what looks to be a copper thing with a light layer of the magic superconductor on the surface and a big neodymium magnet nearby, and the small coin-shaped object is moving around. But if anyone's ever played with lens effect copper and magnets, copper will move around if you put a big strong magnet. So whether or not they put the superconductor or not, it would have almost identical behavior. So I'm not quite sure what the point of the video was, if any.
Okay, now, some time ago I sent you the ESS, which is the third quarter of 22, but then I sent you from the recent one, which was 2023. Did you have a chance to go over it?
Yeah, I got it. I just didn't know what flight you wanted me to do with it. It's, I don't know, it's a bunch of articles. It's a bunch of YouTube.
I didn't want you to look at all of them. It's just that you have any remarks in that area.
Oh, okay. I mean, it doesn't really, at least for me, because it was kind of disconnected. What it basically amounts to is three YouTubes, and they have some slightly annoying music in the background, and just text rolls of all the modifications that were done for the facility. Didn't really go into detail about what those modifications would lead to, but, you know, it's sort of like the repair plans on your plumbing. You know, I guess if you got to pay the bill, it's of interest, but as long as you're not paying the bill, give me the results. I'm much more result-oriented than building the tool that derives the results.
Right, the only what I don't understand is, who is the major player there? Who is really financing all of that?
I don't know. I'm sure you can look it up someplace.
Well, one thing I see, the detector group scientific activities on the control system, those are guys from Sweden, Luden's lab in Sweden on it. I was completely unprepared because while you started the TechNet, I just connected the antenna. Got out from the ladder and was trying to be fast to be there. But anyhow, we're going to leave it for later. But it's nothing special. And to exchange.
Okay, Wes. Like I said, I know you have to kind of build test equipment to figure out how to measure things, but you know, I tend to be more interested with the results and the measurements, what the measurement means, what that means to the whole nature of space and time and stuff, rather than, you know, we lengthened the tube, we doubled the power of the generator and what have you.
Yeah, I was doing some measurements today, even POC, very much unique set of tools, not much used today because they have much more sophisticated one, the communication over the 500 kilowatts transmission, high voltage line, but we spoke about it briefly, so I think I'm going to pass off today. Thank you very much, and to wish you any special way.
Okay, very good, Wesley. Thanks again for participating, as always. This is, again, AC2GS with the Limar Technical Met. And we still have a little bit of time to kill. If anyone wants to chat maybe about the nonsensical UFO congressional committee, then, you know, or any other subject, hit that push to talk.
Actually, I have one.
Okay.
I was thinking you have an antenna. Let's say the antenna, like a Tesla coil, right? The primary is 2-3 watts, the secondary is like 1,000 watts, whatever. But anyhow, any antenna, this could be any antenna. And actually, magic transformer, I have few magic transformers from Hewlett Packard from 1970. And one is 600 ohms, and the other one 125 ohms. So I had a generator, the device, the impedance meter is made this way. It's from 90s, from signal crafters, that you have impedance meter, but you need to connect the generator into it. And then by tuning the generator, you can sweep the frequency of interest. So I connected like the 3 winds. And of course it was less than 100 ohms. But then if I put it through the 600 ohm matching transformer, I was able to match the impedance. So in other words, I came to the conclusion that you can match any impedance you want. Your 3 ohms, 5 ohms, 10 ohms of the antenna, or you have 1 kilowatt of an antenna, all you need is just a transformer. You can call it balloon, you can call it any way you want it. It's a transformer. And you can choose your impedance of your choice. Depends from what you like. If your generator is 200 ohms, then you can do it. It's not a big deal. Before I was under the impression that, okay, I have a 50 ohm, everything has to be 50 ohm because it's a standard, it's a 50 ohm. Well, you can have a random piece of wire. This random piece of wire is going to have a different impedance. Now, you don't know what is the impedance of the wire, right? But you have to match it. How are we going to match it? So, yes, we have the MFJ. We could, but it's limited. So, most of the people go for the magic device, with very low frequency. Then they go for impedance meter, the cheap one, Chinese one. They could go for the VNA whatsoever. But then you disconnect the VNA and the impedance change, because the wires played the role there. Back to you.
Well, the idea is you should adjust your VNA most of the time with a known standard series of 50 ohms shorts and opens, because the transmission line can affect the results. But yeah, ultimately you can transform any impedance from one to another, given the proper circuit design and the proper value of inductances and capacitance. With a set range of capacitance or inductance, it sort of depends upon the design of the impedance matching circuit. If it's a T network, if it's a pi network, if it's an L network, they all sweep out in different portions of the Smith chart. But all things being equal, if you can have access to an infinite varied amount of inductance and capacitance, you can transform any impedance to another impedance.
Yeah, but something that I don't believe many people look at, We worked from 1.8 to 28 megahertz. We have radios that are at 50 ohms at the output. The antennas that should match. And the many people think that in low frequencies the impedance match is not important. What is it, 1 kilohertz, 2 kilohertz, 3 kilohertz? It's not important. No matter what's there. But actually at the 9.6 kilohertz, people make the communication, send the Morse code. At 17.6, they do the same. Of course, that depends from which country it is and what rules there are there. Let me jump. Okay. Now the strange thing is that because I have my impedance meter that I have from signal crafters works this way, that I have 2 watts signal generator, 2 watts signal generator. And then I have another device which is called impedance meter, but impedance meter needs that generator to be connected to it. And then it's going to show you the results. And of course you can calibrate it based on the manual, well, the way it is. So let's say my random antenna, which was like the few winds, 3-4 winds of copper tubing of the diameter 15 inches, there was the antenna, was below 100 hertz, I'm sorry, 100 ohms. But I connected 600 ohm Hewlett Packard matching transformer, and then to the output of the transformer I connected that few winds. And to my surprise, I was able to match 50 ohm of the output of the generator that is connected to the impedance meter to the antenna. Very few ohms using 600 ohm transformer, matching transformer. And perfectly matched. Of course, when I was changing the frequency, I had to tune it. But anyhow, there is this, to my surprise, there is always the set of frequencies when you can match any antenna at any frequency, at any impedance you want. Back to you.
Okay, yeah, I mean, once again, you can pretty much change any impedance to another impedance, no matter what the frequency is. Obviously, if it's a DC circuit, it has no reactive. It's purely resistive. But if it has intermittent alternating currents, yeah, you can change the impedance.
Right. So what I could do is, I could connect directly my random antenna directly to the impedance meter and measure, okay, I have a 3 ohms, fine, it's 3 ohms. But then I had no matching. It's 3 ohms, I cannot match it. But I didn't have a proper matching transformer. I had just those two Hewlett Packards. So, it's funny, but anyhow, good entertainment. I don't have any more stuff for today. Back to you.
Okay, very good. Thanks again, as always. This continues to be AC2GS with the Limark Technical Net. Anyone else have any topics or comments to make for tonight? Okay, I guess I'll just bring it up. The UFO, they call it UAP, I think, this week. The Congress has nothing better to do. It had a get-together with the usual suspects. There is this guy who used to be in the government and thankfully isn't anymore. And he tells these tall tales about how everyone fessed up to him that we have aliens and we keep alien equipment. And he never saw any of it, but it's kind of like people tell him stories. You know, I think he was the slow kid in the lunchroom that that there's a legit guys would kind of make up stories and tell him. But nevertheless, came there with, I think, a couple of pilots. Pilots are nice guys, wonderful people. They don't necessarily know anything about this particular subject. There's all kinds of weird things, perspective tricks that cause people to misinterpret things that they see. And so the gaggle of them got together in Congress and started to tell tall tales. This is one of the more weirder premises that I think this guy came up with was these might not be aliens. They might just be our descendants from the future who have discovered time travel. So hopefully in those future times they've invented some psychiatric pill to deal with this guy's problem, because I don't think the medical science has any answers for him at this point. But they actually wasted, I think, at least a day, it might have been longer, on this nonsense. And I don't understand why.
Intuition.
Yes, Wesley.
So let's say a lot of things is possible, but we don't have a time travel. It's physically impossible. You cannot go back in time. So if there is somebody in the future, he has to go back in time. You cannot go back in time. That's correct.
Well, I don't know. I mean, time travel, I can enjoy a well-written time travel, a plot device on a science fiction novel. There's a lot of very big problems with time travel. If you develop all kinds of possibilities to screw everything up. It's called the grandfather paradox. If you travel back in time and you shoot your grandfather before your grandfather has your father, then you never existed. But if you never existed, then you wouldn't go back in time and shoot your grandfather. And so it goes round and round and round forever. And there are clever science fiction writers who say, aha, I have the solution. What we have is an infinite number of parallel universes, and when you go back into time, you're not going back into your time dimension, you're going into another time dimension where your father never existed and you never existed. So you're not moving really back, you're moving kind of back and sideways. We don't know. There's no practical method to go back in time. There's lots of practical ways to go forward fast in time. If you somehow had a propellant that allowed you to travel at near relativistic speed, your local time would slow down. You could kind of travel, I don't know, to the edge of the solar system, turn around and travel back. And it would only be, if you were fast enough, would only be a year or something, and all your friends and family would have died hundreds of years earlier. So we can all travel forward in time if we figure out a way to run an engine at relativistic speeds, but no one has a clue of how to do it in the past. They have kind of played around with the theoretical concept these little tears in space-time, I forgot what they call them again, but the wormhole. You have to find a wormhole, which no one's seen, drag one into the future, and then the other portion would be in the past. It would be an engineering nightmare if they actually even exist. So, yeah, time machine. I'm not going to bet on those either.
So far, physics is made on models, so no time travel, no back in time, no over unity, no, there was something, something that people wish to have, wish that happened, but not going to happen. It's simply impossible. In order for us to break the rules of physics, you have to create a new model. I'm going to think about it. Back to you.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
Yeah, I didn't see this one on with Congress. I heard about it, but I did not see it. And I don't know what character they had testifying, but I would imagine if it was years ago, they would have had this guy, Art Bell. I don't know if you remember that name. You know, he